Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Double Cross Radio, coming to you live from the Jefferson Republic, and that's Northern California, Southern Oregon, the counties that border along the border between California and Oregon. We call ourselves the Jefferson Republic, and tonight we have a great show for you, but before we get into that, I'm going to bring on also my co-host, Drew Lamb, my co-host and good friend, Drew Lamb. Drew, how you doing?
Doing well.
All right.
You back in the States. Well, yes. Not really. I was kind of worried about you making it back.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was kind of worried about coming back into the country.
I think I
found some amazing people down in Mexico. I loved them. They were awesome.
If I left, I probably wouldn't come back.
We were thinking about it. We have our dogs here, though. They would bring us back. We have to come back and take care of the dogs. Tonight we're going to be talking about Universidad Francisco Merquin. I think I said it right, but probably not very well. And we're going to have the president of that university, Dr. Gabriel Calzada. And we're going to be bringing him on, so we'll just say hello to him right now, and then I'll give him a better introduction in a few minutes. Welcome to the show, Dr. Calzada.
Hello.
Now on, you'll probably be Gabriel.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Thank you for inviting me to the program.
Oh, thank you for coming on. We have just a couple of real short things we have to take care of before we get going. We had there was a forest fire that burned out of control to in Siskiyou County, south of us, between our show last week and today, and it destroyed over 200 homes in Weed, California, including one of our frequent contributors to our Facebook page. Her family lost, I mean, they didn't lose any lives, thank goodness, but they lost a lot of personal belongings. They're just gone forever, and they can't be replaced no matter how much insurance you have, and it's just a real tragedy for those families. But the community is pulling together, and we want everybody to know that we've talked about these fires at length for two different shows this year so far, this summer, and looks like we're going to be having to do another one because this is a big story, and we really, too many people just say, oh, it was an act of God, it was a lightning storm, and it was, this kind of tragedy didn't have to happen. It's because of government mismanagement, and I don't know why we keep trusting them with this valuable resource, but we do. So anyway, I want everybody to know that that are down there, the people that might be listening in tonight, down there in Weed, California, we're all praying for you, and hope that things start getting better for you. It was a little cooler last night. Maybe they got all those fires kind of under control for a while. The second thing, and I should have written this down because I've already forgotten what it was. Oh, Drew, you had something you wanted to share about the... Was that just... chat before the show. I don't know. Did you want to talk? I think you should talk about your soldier flies.
I talk about this on my off-grid journey radio show fairly often. My product that I've created called the Black Soldier Fly Compost Inoculator, and what this enables you to do is to take your food scraps that you normally throw away in the garbage and to convert them into protein that you could feed to your chickens or to your fish. So my soldier fly larvae process that material. They eat it, and they grow very quickly, and they're very rich in protein. So I've been working with a Northern California cellar, a wine producer, and they've been doing experiments with my black soldier fly larvae to see if they would process their grape pomace. And so far, the tests have been successful, and they've been seeking more consultation from me and, of course, more compost inoculators so they could try to scale up and then learn how to breed them themselves. So I'm very pleased with this. And so this product is brand new for me. So I'm getting a good reception from this, and I'm very pleased. If any of you are interested in this, you could go to ladybugindoorgardens.com and just call them and tell them you want some black soldier fly larvae, and they could get you set up with payment and shipping out. And or if you want to purchase with Bitcoin, just send me an email, drew@pyramidpurefoods.com, and we could work something out. I wouldn't mind having some Bitcoin in my wallet right now. So thanks for the opportunity to talk about that, Chuck.
Yeah. And Gabriel, you might want to, if you have an agricultural department at the university, you may want to add Drew on the faculty.
Oh.
He is a trailbreaker in this technology of, you know, making high protein food that you can feed to chickens and fish out of garbage.
That's fantastic. We have the nutrition faculty, but we don't have agriculture, unfortunately.
Oh, well.
I was an economics major at the university here, but I dropped out to start a business.
Okay. So I'm going to give Dr. Calzada a formal introduction. He received his PhD from the University of Rey Juan Carlos in economics in Madrid, and he served there as a professor also. Prior to being named president of UFM, and that's the Universidad Francisco Marroquin, in 2012, he served as the president.
Or University of Free Marketeers is also known as, University of Free Marketeers, but mainly in the States.
Okay. But he also served as president of the Institute of Juan de Mariana in Madrid, and I believe he started that one too. In 2005, his career in free market public policy has encompassed both academia and activism. So welcome to the show formally.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes. And I had just a little brief information for all the listeners and yourself, too. I first became aware of UFM while I was at Freedom Fest this summer in Las Vegas. And they were one of the booths there that was just showing what they were doing, and they were kind of explaining the concept, and I was kind of interested in what they were doing, and they were kind of focused on economics. And then they said, yes, all the students have to take a year of Austrian economics. And I says, what? And I stayed there for another 2 hours talking to those people. I finally said, this guy will never leave. But it was so interesting and exciting that actually this has become a mainstream idea in Guatemala. And So I hung around long enough that I got to meet Lisa Roberts, and she said that I told her we had this radio show, and she said that somebody from the university may be able to come on and talk to us. And I was just blown away when we found out it was going to be the president of the university, which is just unbelievably great news. But in reading the bio for you, I noticed this other institute that you founded. The namesake of this institution, the Juan de Mariana, we've actually talked about him briefly a couple times on our show, and I just think that was amazing. That I guess that in Spain he's more highly thought of than he is around the rest of the world. But hardly anybody in America knows who he is, and but I do, because I'm very interested in Austrian economics, and I was reading a book on the Spanish scholastics because they were kind of the forerunners. They actually introduced a lot of the ideas which were later incorporated into and helped foundationally build the Austrian theories. And so I was really interested in reading about them. They were amazing thinkers and philosophers and economists, and they were really more philosophers than anything else, but their economic insights were dead on. They were really good. And I'm going to let you talk about Juan de Mariana, because you know a lot more about him than I do, but I just want to say this one thing about him. He wrote a book in the early 17th century, in 1603, I don't forget the date, it's not important, but it was called, it was about tyrannicide, or about the justification to assassinate a king if he was being immoral and he was imposing taxes without consent, seizing property, and, you know, and or preventing democratic meetings of parliaments, kind of like what Abraham Lincoln did. So maybe John Wilkes Booth was a justified assassin. I don't know. But anyway, I think that was a really great concept that kings and rulers and leaders are not above the law, that they have to deal with the same law that everybody else has to deal with. And I thought that was really important concept, that our natural rights are the top of the pyramid, not the king. And he also had many other incredible economic insights, and I'm going to let you talk about that because I'll miss some of them.
Well, that book is a very interesting book. In fact, it's a book that he did by chapters. He was asked by a friend of him, by a friend of Juan de Mariana, who was named the preceptor of the future king of Spain, the son of Philip II, who would become Philip III. A friend of Juan de Mariana was named tutor of Philip III, or son of Philip II, and he didn't know what to teach to the prince. So he turned to his friend Juan de Mariana, who was considered the wisest person probably in Europe at that point, and he asked him, "What should I teach the prince?" And Juan de Mariana started writing chapter by chapter what later was became the book on the prince. The Rege is the name in Latin of the book, and the book is really outstanding. The book sets all kind of limits to the government, all kind of limits to the exercise of power, of political power. It starts by saying that the ultimate retainers of political powers are the individuals, and that only the individuals can give power to the government, and that if the government becomes tyrannical, and even if the king becomes tyrannical, it doesn't have the right anymore to rule, to exercise power, and that the people and the individuals can stop him. And that if they don't want to stop, the people can stop them by force, using force in order to stop the actions of the tyrant and committing tyrannicide. So, but the most interesting thing is the book is every chapter is a new limit to the exercise of political power. But the very interesting thing, or the very interesting anecdote, is that the book was well accepted, even among the kings and the court. It was well accepted. The problem with Juan de Mariana came when he wrote a book about inflation, and he explained what inflation was about. This was in 1609. He explained what inflation was about and how the government commit mass robbery when engaging in inflation. And then it was when Philip III persecuted Juan de Mariana, and he was in prison for around a year.
Okay. And I think some people have said that this, I've read that there's possibly a king in France that was assassinated by people who had read this book, and so the French banned the book from France, and he may have possibly been the first author to ever have a book banned.
Well, yes, he was one of the very first authors to have a book banned. His book was not only banned, was they tried to find all the copies everywhere around the world and burn them. It happens with both books, in fact. First with the book on money, and later with the book on the education of the prince. And in fact, today it's very hard. If you have a copy of one of the first editions of Juan de Mariana, keep it or try to sell it for a very good price because there are so few copies. They were so efficient. The government was so efficient finding all the copies and burning all the copies that it's extremely expensive to the copy of one of those books of Juan de Mariana. Juan de Mariana participated, he was asked, or he was almost ordered by the Jesuits to that was his order, to participate in the list of prohibited books of the Inquisition. And he tried always to relax the list and open the list and reduce the prohibition. It is funny that later he fought for years trying to open this list or to accept a larger variety of books. And it's interesting that his colleagues later would ban his books. And as you say, it was one of the very first books to be banned. Yes.
Yeah, and all of the Spanish scholastics, I think, were amazing writers, amazing thinkers. They came up with a lot of concepts that were later incorporated into the Austrian theory. I think one of the to me, when I finally fully understood this. All of a sudden, everything that I'd kind of just accepted, all of a sudden I knew exactly why it worked the way it did, and that was subjective theory, subjective value theory, I guess. And I don't think that one was necessarily Mariana. I think that was a different one of the scholastics that came up with this one, but I think Mariana may have helped him in the writing of the book or something, or may have co-authored it with him or something, or the paper. But that's a really important concept, and something that all of the United States being mainly a former English colony and still having ties to the British Empire, we were pretty dominated by the thinking and writing of Adam Smith, and Adam Smith missed this entirely. He didn't get it.
You're totally right. In fact, these authors are incredibly interesting. Some of them studied for years the theory of prices and what is a just price. They had a lot of moral questions. In order to answer them, they understood that they need to understand economics. And so, after years of discussion, their conclusion was that the just price it has to be the free price. Only the free price can be just. Any other price that is not a free price is unjust. Or, for example, they discuss about the labor theory of value. And after long discussions, their conclusion was that value is related to a subjective value theory, and that there is nothing, something like labor theory of value. Is something that you have to you engage in so many contradictions when you try to defend something like that, that is something that's impossible, that the value depends on the individual and on its subjective valuation. They discussed the issue of taxes, and they found out that taxes produced a lot of distortions changed the relative price system, and this harmed the trade and the accumulation of wealth. Some of the scholastic authors started competition, and they didn't follow the what is today the fashionable trend of thinking that competition is something is a system where everybody has to sell the same kind of goods, the same price, with the same cost, but they thought that competition was something that was a process of frivolity, that people had to bring new ideas, and it was related with disruption. So these authors were tremendously interesting. Of course, Juan de Mariana studied inflation. as we mentioned, and show that inflation was a system of mass robbery, and it had to the kings had to stop this kind of policy. So there were really interesting authors, and as you say, they were forerunners of what we call today the Austrian School of Economics.
Yeah, and Murray Rothbard often he said that Adam Smith for all the good things he did, he probably still set economics back 100 years because he didn't get the stuff that the Spanish scholastics had discovered. So I just think that it's great that your institute in Spain was dedicated to one of those, I guess one of the leaders of that group. And I knew right away this was going to be a great interview when I read that this morning. Let's move on to the talking about the University of, or the UFM, the University of Free Minds. The university was founded in 1971, if I'm correct, by Manuel Ayau?
Yes, Manuel Ayau, perfect.
Ayau, okay. Manuel yes. Ayau. And I'm going to let you tell us about him. He was also the author of a book we want to talk about towards the end of the discussion, but well, I'm going to save that to the end because it's I want to talk about some fundraising along with that book. So tell us about his vision and how he started the university and how it's progressed in about 43 years since he founded it.
Well, the story of the university is an amazing story. Manuel Ayau, he was a young entrepreneur. He went to the U.S., he went to study to the U.S., to Canada. He came back to Guatemala, and he couldn't understand why was Guatemala poor. Guatemala had great natural resources, great people, hard-working people. It's a country very close to the United States, the biggest economic market. So he wanted to understand why his country was a poor country. And he couldn't understand that based on the economic theory he had learned in school. So he started discussing this with a group of friends, also most of them young entrepreneurs, very young entrepreneurs. And at one point, after reading many things that didn't make sense to them, they read a small pamphlet published by Foundation for Economic Education. And this pamphlet was written by Ludwig von Mises. And finally, they found an author that would tell them something that makes sense to them. So they started a think tank in order to discuss these ideas. And years later, Manuel Ayau decided that this was not something that should be kept for a reduced group of people, but something that should be disseminated in the society, in the Guatemalan society. So they started deciding what should we do in order to disseminate and teach these ideas of freedom, individual responsibility, free markets. And some of his friends said, well, we should do public policy, we should start a newspaper, we should do some lobbying. And his answer or his point was, no, look, for example, in order to start a newspaper or radio, we need people that already understand and are enthusiastic about the ideas of freedom. So what we need is to teach those ideas, and this is something we can do with the university. So for a long period of time, he tried to establish this university. Finally, he managed to open the university in 1971, as you said. And since then, the mission of the university has been to teach and disseminate the ethical, legal, and economic ideas of a society of free and responsible individuals. The university has been doing a lot of different things in order to follow its mission. And it has been growing, not so much in the number of students. I mean, we have many applications, but the university is still today a small university. We try to focus on quality, not on quantity. But this university has been growing a lot in terms of the use of technology, in terms of the methodologies we use, in terms of the research, in the interdisciplinary atmosphere that we have created. So the university is really a dream of a group of young, free-minded people, freedom-loving people, that has become true. And some of the founders, some of the people that work with Manuela Yao, close to Manuela Yao, trying to create this, to make this dream come true, tell me every time I meet them, say, this is something I'm still today, after 42 years, or 43 years, still today, it's incredible. Every time they enter this beautiful campus, I have to repeat myself, is this really true? Isn't it a dream? And so I invite everybody to come here, because for a person that loves liberty, freedom, it's really something special to come to the campus to see the Ludwig von Mises Library, the Friedrich Hayek Auditorium, the Milton Friedman Auditorium, the Adam Smith Plaza, and all these beautiful places we have dedicated to the great defenders of liberty, and all the projects we have where we try to continue to carry on the great enterprises that those authors started some time ago.
Okay, I'm going to do a slight detour here, and I hate to bring this up, but I think it's something that we have to kind of talk about and get out of the way, because I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about the safety of life in Guatemala. I know that there have been a couple of people have been kidnapped there by criminal gangs and whatever, and then things like that can happen anywhere in the world, including the United States. And the people that I've talked to who have gone to actually been in Guatemala, in fact, when I was flying back from my recent vacation, I was sitting next to somebody or behind somebody who was coming back from a church mission in Guatemala. She said it was just the most wonderful experience of her life. She said she felt totally safe there, safer than any city in the United States over a million people. She didn't never feel as safe as she felt in Guatemala. So can you also verify this information that I'm telling you? I'm sure there's places where you go that maybe are kind of places you should stay away from, just like there are in any country, any big city. But it's a relatively safe environment for people that want to travel there and visit your school or to see what it's all about. Is that correct?
The school is totally safe. We have people visiting the school every week. We haven't had a problem. Well, it is true that the country, you cannot say that Guatemala is one of the safest countries in the world. You have neighborhoods where you shouldn't enter certain neighborhoods. You shouldn't use some kind of public transportation. You should use some other kind of private transportation. And there's, every time you move to a different culture, you should get information about safety in this country. In our case, since the campus is very safe and the surrounding of the campus are very safe, what we try to tell everybody that comes is the way you should move in Guatemala in order to feel safe and to be safe. Of course, the news you hear are usually related to some gangs and some certain neighborhoods and areas where the war on drugs have produced a sort of battle over the domination of certain pathways where the drug goes from one country to another, and most of the news we hear internationally are related to consequences of the war on drugs, but fortunately, they are very circumscribed to certain areas. But I guess we can say the same about many, many different countries. The case of kidnapping that you mentioned, well, it's not really a problem in Guatemala, fortunately, because in some other countries it is a problem, and kidnapping usually is a very different reality, and people do this usually for either political reasons or for economic reasons, and it's very difficult to protect yourself from that kind of criminality. Unfortunately, in Guatemala, you don't find this. So in this sense, it is also pretty safe.
Yeah, everybody that I've talked to said that they would do smart things, like they wouldn't go out after it got really dark.
Yes, for sure.
And they would, if they're going to go somewhere, if you're going to go on public transportation, they would go in a group instead of by themselves,
yeah.
Or things like
exactly.
That. It's not something that's gonna. I guess if you gambled and took a chance every day, it might catch up with you eventually. But it's not as dangerous as some people would make it out to be. And I don't think that if you have a mind to go there and visit, because I'm going to go there and visit. I think this is just an amazing place.
Well, I come from Europe. I came here 2 years ago. I haven't had any problem. I know of people that have had problems. I know of many people that have never in their life had any problem. And usually this is related to the kind of habits that you have. If you, after dark, you only travel safe, you don't have problem. If you just walk in the street with a laptop in your hand after dark, you might have problems in Guatemala. This is for sure. I mean, this is not Sweden. It's not the Northern European countries were one of those countries where when a wallet is stolen, it will come in the front page of a newspaper. But it's also a country where criminality has some patterns, and you can protect yourself from that.
Okay, so I don't want anybody to be afraid of something that they hear on a radio show somewhere or read in a newspaper, because a lot of that is kind of sensationalized. We're not saying there are no problems, but they're not. They shouldn't deter you if you're interested in this. Now, I guess the next thing there is we need to know is if someone was interested in going to school there, what kinds of areas of study are available for them to deal in?
Well, UFM has started with economics and law mainly, and social science. And economics is still very, very important at our university, business administration, entrepreneurship. We are starting a new study in entrepreneurship. We have computer science also starting next year. But it goes from that area to areas like medicine, like dentistry, architecture, nutrition, psychology, political science, international relations. So I think I mentioned law. So we have a large variety of studies, mainly everything in social sciences, architecture, medicine, those areas are well covered by our degrees, and of course the most successful of all is economics and business administration in terms of the number of students, but in terms of prestige and also number of students, but in terms of the number of the of students that try to enter UFM, medicine will be a very important. It's also a very important faculty for us. And architecture, it's also a faculty with a great international prestige. And so we offer a large variety of studies. We do not offer currently most of the engineering studies that you can do at the engineering university. University is specialized in engineering, but we have business engineering, or what in many countries is called commercial engineering, and we have computer science. So then we have, of course, the graduate studies we offer. We offer graduate studies in social science, in diverse number of fields. And we also offer MBAs. In fact, this is interesting, two kinds of MBAs. We have two MBAs competing with each other. One MBA is disruptive MBA, where this is the Acton MBA at UFM, that where only entrepreneurs can teach, and where those entrepreneurs have to make questions. They cannot give the answers or give long lectures, but they have to make questions. And then we have another MBA, the same building, competing with the first one, that is, in fact, our original MBA. This is more traditional, more traditionally oriented MBA, but still there. It's an MBA where free market ideas are very, very important, and also a place where entrepreneurship is one of the main fields that you study at the MBA. So it depends mainly if you... if we're talking about undergrad or graduate studies, but UFM has a large variety of degrees, offering a large variety of degrees. We have only 3,000 students or 2,900 students, and the reason why we have so many fields and so few students is because we try to, our methodology is mainly collaborative methodologies. We use collaborative methodologies in all our studies, so we try to keep our classes small, try to have Socratic dialogue and collaborative learning. So most of you will see that most of our classes are we try to keep them under 15, so 12 students, 15 students. And the campus is a beautiful campus. You can visit the website www.ufm.edu, and you will see this like a botanical garden, a beautiful place where we have all these we offer all these studies I just mentioned.
Yes, and I was just going to point out it, when you look at those pictures, it almost looks like the college has just been carved out of the jungle. It's at the same time it looks like it exactly belongs where it is. And so I think maybe some of your, were there some people on staff in the architecture that planned this and designed it? Because it really is beautifully done.
Well, the interesting thing is that Manuel Ayal, when he saw the ravine where the university, the campus was built, where everybody saw a dirty ravine, he saw a beautiful campus. He saw a place where we could have a arboretum or a botanical garden, where we could have the buildings following the forms of the valley, of the ravine, and where he saw a private a case of a botanical preservation of a valley of Guatemala, preserved or run by private institution, and the university has been trying since the campus was built to preserve all the species, to document all the species, to create a website dedicated to show the different animal and botanical species that we have in the campus. And in fact, the university won an award for the preservation of this natural legacy. that we try to show that it's possible with without any public funds, without any subsidies, without getting money from through taxes from other people. So I think it's it's not just very beautiful, but it's a beautiful case of natural preservation through private institution.
Yeah, so it's
money, voluntary. It
shows that it's possible.
Yes,
which is important for a lot of people. Now, despite what your major is, everybody has to take a year of Austrian economics. That's am I correct?
Yes, that's correct. In fact, it's even more than that. Despite your major, you need a semester on the ethics of liberty. You are required to take another semester on basic economics, and a third semester on advanced economics, a fourth semester on applied economics, and usually also a semester on Mises and Hayek. These courses on economics are mostly Austrian economics, as you mentioned. We also teach public choice and Chicago school economics. I mean, Chicago school economics and also experimental economics. So we try to have all the branches or schools of free market economics of what we call in Europe liberalism in our program, in our required courses. But as you say, it is mainly or the most important of those schools is Austrian economics. So the founders of the university were very influenced by Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek, and you can see this in the program. It's very clear that Austrian economics is probably I would say the core of those courses on liberty, both from the ethical point of view and also from the economic point of view.
Well, are most of your students they're people from Guatemala?
Yes, most of our students are from Guatemala. We have also students from Central America, from Honduras, from Nicaragua, from El Salvador, from Mexico, from Costa Rica. And we have had over the years, we have always had some students from the U.S., very few, but we always receive some students from the U.S., mainly students that already, like the ideas of liberty, they learn about our university, they learn about the prestige of our programs, and they also see the difference in price between good U.S. universities and UFM, and we have been receiving students from the U.S. over the years, but mainly, as you say, mainly from Guatemala and the region.
Well, I think this has to be making an impact on society in Guatemala, that these people are learning these concepts and they're going to be basically the leaders of your economy over time. They've been there for 43 years, so you have a couple generations that have gone through, and this has to be making some inroads into how people see things in your country or in that country. I guess your country is Spain, but for the natives of Guatemala, and I would think that the potential is there, that maybe in another generation or two that you could see a transformation in society where it becomes about the freest place in the Western Hemisphere. And if that were to happen, that it would become very prosperous also.
Well, that's what we think that's going to happen. In fact, I would say that it's already happening. There's several examples you can look at. Well, one of them is telecommunication. In Guatemala is one of the freest countries in the world in that area of telecommunication. And the law of telecommunication that we have is a law that, the idea of that law started in the environment of UFM, of the university, and the spectrum, the radioelectric spectrum, was privatized. Many people, many institutions are owners of the radioelectric spectrum. A lot of things are tried in Guatemala because it's cheap, and you can have a part of the spectrum. You can try. You can engage in trial and error, and you can see today in Guatemala how everybody, even the poorest people, you can find in places where you don't have electricity, have smartphones, have cellular phones, and very often smartphones, and they cannot recharge. They cannot charge these phones because they don't have electricity, but they go to a store where they would charge the mobile phone for you through a generator or through a solar panel. So it's quite incredible to see what the liberalization, the application of the idea of free market have done in that sector. Also, the currency in Guatemala, it's one of the most stable currencies in Latin America, and it also is because of some graduate students from the university that after discussing monetary issues during their years at the university, they decided to change the laws and to have a proposal where they change the law in such a way that the government or the central bank cannot monetize the debt of the government. Also, a law that allows everybody to make the contracts in the or open bank accounts in the currency that you want, and all these kind of laws has placed limits to the interventionist, to the monetary interventionist of the government and of the central bank, and has rendered Guatemalans with a currency that is incredibly stable if you look at the other countries. So you already see the results. You can already see a lot of results in Guatemala. Obviously, I think you have now the first generations, the first couple of generations out. We hope that in a few years, with more generations coming out of UFM, we will see many other reforms, free market reforms, and we will see a very prospering country, a country that will grow, and will not just grow in terms of in arithmetic and quantitative terms, but also in qualitative terms, in terms of enjoying your personal freedom. So we are very optimistic about that.
Yeah, now, as a part of it, I kind of alluded to this at the start of the show. This is, we call ourselves as being residents of the Jefferson Republic, which is we're kind of recognizing the governing bodies of the state of Oregon, state of California, or the United States government. We think we're free and independent people, and we can choose who we want to align ourselves with if we do. But kind of got off subject a little bit here myself. In getting back into that, in Guatemala, because of your situation of becoming, you actually have become that, you're starting to become that way. You're free and independent people, where you're not going to be owing anything to a central bank. You're not going to have any. You have laws that make open, honest competition possible. You don't have a regulating body that writes regulations that benefit large corporations at the expense of small businesses, and so you're making a free economy that's probably, you know, it could be unrivaled in the rest of the world. We talked about this with regards to the state of, or the Republic, Jefferson Republic, back earlier in the year. They're going to have a ballot measure and vote for it, and it narrowly went down to defeat, kind of like what Scotland is doing now, only I think this was a better initiative. And in talking on our show, we were kind of comparing what is possible with what has happened to Hong Kong. Hong Kong is just a rock that sits out in the middle of a harbor. They have almost no natural resources at all. They have to import almost all their food and all their water. And this is the richest place on the planet. And certainly a country like Guatemala has a lot more natural resources than a rock sitting out in the middle of a harbor. And you're the potential for what Guatemala could be is much greater than what Hong Kong is now. It could be the richest place on the planet. And all it needs is for people just to continue along this road. It's not something where you snap the fingers and it happens right away. It takes a little time. People have to trust the system and put their time and effort into producing things for other people to benefit for themselves. And they have to realize, they have to do that for a while to realize that, hey, this is working. And then they'll put more effort and time and energy into it, and it'll work better. And their children will see what their parents are doing, and they will copy their behaviors, and it'll be better again. And so it takes a while to get to that point. But your words are they're kind of reinforcing what I thought was happening down there, just from how I figured it would be happening. If more and more people knew the truth, more and more people would use the truth to get to a better place. So I'm really salute you for all this. In the remaining moments that we have, it's been interesting. I've just been fascinated what you had to say. If you could tell us a little bit about, we've talked about the kinds of majors we have or fields of study that are available. What could someone expect to pay in terms of tuition, living costs, travel? Let's say if there were some students in the United States that are listening to this, or maybe someone who has a grandchild or a niece or nephew or their own children that they would want to look into this as a possibility, what kind of expenses could they expect?
Well, when it comes to the tuitions, you would be talking about, it depends on the study, right? If you're studying, let's say the most expensive majors, the most expensive degrees you can do at UFM are probably architecture, medicine, and economics, and you're talking about $5,000, $6,000 per year, approximately. So it's significant. Well, I come from Europe. I come from a private university in Europe, where you would expect to pay six times more, approximately.
I think in the United States, at least three times more for one of this quality, probably six or eight times more. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's for the quality that UFM delivers. It's really, I think it's a bargain. It's very low. Then it comes the cost of living here, I would say you can live around the campus, and for example, for $700 a month, you could have a small place, small room with a breakfast and some services included, and probably for $1,200 a month, you could have have all your expenses. So if you add these two things, this is what you would need to live in Guatemala and to pay the tuition of the university, of the most expensive degrees at the university. So I'm not sure about the U.S., but if you compare it with Europe, even with public universities in Europe, it's significantly cheaper than studying in Europe. And in fact, in the last few years, we have found that some students came not because of that, but mainly because they knew about the reputation of UFM, and they knew about the focus in free market and individual responsibility that UFM has, but combining that, the quality of UFM and the prices, they thought that it was a great deal, and they came here to study with us. So this is what I could say about prices.
Are there any special requirements that students have to meet to be accepted into the school? Or do they interview them, or they have to write papers or anything like that, or...?
Yes, we have an admission. One of the good things, I didn't mention that, but one of the fantastic things of Guatemala is that in Guatemala, the government cannot intervene the higher education. So the only thing they can do is to in an indirect way, they cannot give you the license in order to become a university. But once you're a university, you are totally free to establish your own rules. So we have a really a competitive market in higher education, and every university established the rules that they think are the best rules in order to allow students to enter the university. So we have our own admission process where we do some tests and interviews, and this is the only requirement we have. In order to get an undergrad title, we students need a high school degree. This is the only requirement we have. Apart from that, it's just to come here, to visit, to be convinced that you want to be at UFM, that you want to study at UFM, that you enjoy the atmosphere here we have created, and you think that this is the best place to have the kind of learning process inspired by all these free-minded people that we mentioned before. And once you are convinced, just come, do the interview, and move to Guatemala.
Yeah, so I'm ready to come down there. I don't know if I could. I'm kind of old to be a student, but maybe you have classes that people could pay for to take just as a part-time student or something. Or I could.
Sure, we have that, and it's it's always a good moment to continue your learning process. I mean, I'm sure you continue it through the radio program, but. Please come down and see what we're doing.
I'm going to come down next year sometime for sure. I want to end up the show talking about one last thing. And the founder of the university wrote a book called Not a Zero-Sum Game, and this is published by the university. So I assume that in the proceeds from the sale of this book kind of come back to the university, help support it a little bit. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So I would, first of all, I'm going to order one tonight because my co-host, I have one. I don't want to part with mine, and I think my co-host would really like to have one too. So we're going to order one for him, and then I encourage anybody who's listening to this, either it's a podcast or you're listening live or on a YouTube, that to check this book out and order. It's not a big, heavy book. It's about 60 pages of economic truth, and it's comparable, I think, to the book that Henry Hazlitt wrote, Economics in One Lesson, and it's not written for economics people. It's written for everybody at a level that everybody can understand this. I think anybody above the age of 14 can understand what's being said in this book. It's just fabulous, and it needs to be in the hands of more people. So I would encourage anybody to buy this, if you like it, to buy more copies of it and pass them out to people you know, because this is the truth that people need to know. The economic literacy in America is horrible. And we're just about out of time, so I want to say thank you. And just kind of hang on here and Skype for a few minutes, and after we get the music playing here and we disconnect from the network, I'll say goodbye to you off the air and give you a proper thank you. So thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.
We'll see everybody next week. We're going to be talking about the myths of the rubber barons. And until then, good night, everybody.